was aglow with whirling, transient nodes of thought, careening through a cosmic vapor of invention.
Welcome to Chain Surfer Radio. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we transmit a sexy, high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. In today's show, we're going to be talking about gene patenting, HMOs, robots, genetic programming, Mars Orbiter, Vikings, and much, much more. In the background, right now you're listening to Kavuno on my opening cart. Second, you're going to be listening to Plastic Man's Consumed. Let's switch over to that wonderful piece. Okay. Now, as I said, today we're going to be talking about gene patenting. I just wrote an editorial for Yankee Radical, which is the regional publication of the Democratic Socialists of America in Boston. And that'll be coming out shortly. So all of you who are on the mailing list of the Democratic Socialists of Boston, then you'll read it. But in any case, if you're not, then I'll read it to you right now. Political opposition to the patenting of human genes is mounting. The media has paid relatively little attention to the issue, but that is sure to change in the coming decade. The constraints placed on medicine and agriculture by gene patenting will force profound changes in intellectual property law and the World Trade Organization. Of course, Luddite extremists like Jeremy Rifkin have been decrying gene patenting along with all gene science for some time. But now the potential for human gene patents will create super profitable monopolies, and this has awakened the scientific and biotechnology industries to the threat. Patenting the gene code itself will keep researchers from working on any applications based on or modifying those genes. The American College of Medical Genetics has called for a ban on patenting human genes on the grounds that patenting will result in exorbitant user fees and monopolistic licensing that limits diagnostic genetic testing. In early September, the BBC revealed that the Clinton administration has been negotiating quietly with the British government to devise strategies to prevent human genes from being privately patented. Within 24 hours of discovery, the U.S. National Institutes of Health already makes public genes discovered in labs funded by the International Human Genome public. This prevents patenting unless a company has already filed patent applications on that gene. But the NIH has been in a horse race with former NIH researcher Craig Venter, now a CEO of biotech firm Celera, who has announced that he will sequence and patent the 100 to 140,000 human genes before the International Human Genome Project can. The Department of Energy, which is funding the Human Genome Project, has rebuffed Venter's effort to secure an agreement protecting his patents and has been working with the British to keep human genes in the public domain. In 1980, the U.S. Supreme Court decided in Diamond v. Chakrabarty that the U.S. patent law applied to new life forms created by genetic engineering. The court's 1980 ruling established that living things can be patented so long as the invention is the result of human intervention. The U.S. Patent Office took Diamond v. Chakrabarty and ran with it. In 1985, it decided that plants, seeds, and plant tissues could be patentable. And in 1987, it said, quote, all multicellular living organisms, including animals, could be patentable. Fortunately, the U.S. Patent Office still draws a line against patenting human beings, since the 13th Amendment does outlaw the ownership of human beings. This summer, however, Jeremy Rifkin won an acknowledgement from the U.S. Patent Office that they have never really defined what a human being is. The U.S. Patent Office has already allowed patents on animals that have had human genes spliced into them to create human tissues and enzymes. Rifkin filed for a patent on the creation of human-animal hybrids with the express intent to stop such research if they were granted a patent. But since the genetic boundaries of humanness have not been statutorily defined, the U.S. Patent Office balked. How is an unmodified human gene the result of human invention? U.S. Supreme Court Justice Douglas wrote in 1948, for instance, that, quote, patents cannot issue for the discovery of phenomena of nature. Such are manifestations of the laws of nature, free to all men and reserved exclusively to none. Accordingly, according to current patent law, however, patentable inventions must only be novel, non-obvious, and useful. The argument of the U.S. Patent Office is that once the patent, once the sequence is isolated into a purified form in a gene sequencing lab, decoded and then read off into a computer, it's not a gene anymore, but the result of human invention and therefore intellectual property. As for the argument about owning or patenting a human being, the genome is not a human being, and specific genes are even less so human beings. Within the constraints of the current law, without challenging the fundamental absurdity of gene patenting, the only way for the public sector to fight back is to beat private firms to the punch. As far back as 1991, the NIH tried to start patenting gene sequences discovered by the Human Genome Project, but since this amounted to nationalizing the genome, the Bush administration put a stop to it. The NIH scientist who pushed for the patents was none other than Craig Venter, who subsequently went private. The current strategy of releasing genes into the public domain is better than nationalization, but still does not address the fundamental problem. The basic human gene sequences should not be patentable. I believe techniques for investigating and modifying genes in any genetically engineered sequences probably should be patentable, but the basic sequences that we discover in current humans should be considered our collective property, a discovery of a natural phenomenon, and not an invention. But even if gene sequences are inventions, patent law must be subject to the public interest. Our interest in protecting the system of innovation and research sometimes requires granting patents, but it also sometimes requires declaring inventions to be public property. Our interests in innovation need to be balanced against other interests, such as in broad and equal access to important medical advances. Just as the Mitterrand administration ordered that production of RU486 be continued, since it was, quote, the moral property of all women. The Human Genome Project and arguably all genomes are the common property of humanity. These issues of biopolitics are shaping the politics of the 21st century, just as the struggles over trust busting helped define capitalism for the 20th century. If socialists and progressives don't engage these debates, we leave the field to Luddites who see the tools themselves as the problem, rather than the political and property relations around them. The principal lobby for progressive genetic policy is the Council for Responsible Genetics, which you can find at www.gene-watch.org. Their position paper on gene patenting is at that site under /programs/patents.html. Although I disagree with the Council for Responsible Genetics about cloning and the patenting of genetically modified plants and animals, I urge you to touch base with the Council for Responsible Genetics and its efforts to fight human gene patenting. That was my editorial on human gene patenting, which I am against. Surprise, surprise. One of the few kinds of technological innovations. Well, you know, I'm for the radical democratic technology. Okay, now the big news this week was that the House passed a very strong set of consumer protections for patients and consumers in HMOs. Principally, the ability of people in HMOs to sue their HMOs for damages if they feel they've been denied necessary treatment that should have been covered by their plan. And people have pointed out, responsible critics have pointed out, that hopefully this legislation will not cripple HMOs, as the HMOs claim, because in court, HMOs should be able to prove that it's both in the interests of the consumer and in the interests of the employer, anyone else who has to pay premiums, that there be cost-effective decisions made about the provision of care. And a study had just come out last week in JAMA, which demonstrated that efforts on the part of legislatures or on the part of juries to dictate to managed care and to doctors and hospitals involved in managed care what the appropriate levels of coverage are is kind of absurd. And that is the debate over what's called drive-by deliveries. Now, in the past, 50 years ago, there was a time when it was not unusual for women to spend, say, a week in the hospital after they had a baby. And over the last 50 years, and especially in the last decade, the average stay for women in hospitals has been declining, and declining rapidly under the impacts of managed care. A study was published in JAMA just last week that looked at the impact in Ohio of managed care from 1991 to 1995 and the decline in average length of stay for moms on Medicaid, which is an insurance program for the poor. The average mom in 1991 stayed 2.2 days, and by 1995, just 4 years later, they were staying 1.6 days. And yet the percentage of the newborns who return to the hospital for treatment within a week of birth, now this is the big complaint that the, quote, drive-by, the critics of drive-by deliveries have, is that babies are going to have to come back in because they, you know, the fact that they weren't staying in longer means that diseases that or conditions that they might have had that would have been caught if they'd stayed in an extra day would have need them to be readmitted. And in this particular case, the hospitalization rate within 14 days of birth declined to 1.7% from 2.1% across those 4 years. Now, that's not necessarily good news because managed care can often demonstrate that they keep people out of the hospital. But the more important news is that the rates of morbidity, that is, the rates of sickness in those babies also declined. So that there was no evidence that babies were being made sicker by not staying in hospitals longer. In fact, you know, the evidence goes the other way, that hospitals are pretty sick places to stay. And if you can, as a baby or as an adult, stay out of a hospital, that's a far preferable thing to do. Now you think we have a bad... Here's a case in Iran. It says, an Iranian hospital set up a cell to detain patients who are unable to pay their medical bills. Sina, a state-run hospital in central Tehran, has stationed three guards on the cell in its orthopedic unit around the clock, the daily Aftab-e-Amruz said. To make sure patients will fulfill their financial obligations, we began detaining patients who failed to pay several months ago. We had no other choice. We have to pay our staff and had to assign a room for this purpose. It's also been forced to readmit two inmates for treatment because of injuries they suffered while trying to escape, it quoted several nurses as saying. Okay, so if you have to go to Iran, make sure to have the $2 or $3 that would be necessary to pay for your medical bills. And in other news, let's see, not-for-profit HMOs are better at preventive medicine. This was actually published over the summer in JAMA. And what it shows is... our study suggests that these plans are... It's a study out of Harvard Medical School and the Public Citizen Health Research Group, which is Wool Handler and Himmelstein's operation there. They're lefty single-payer supporters, and they often do very critical research on managed care. The findings show that, using 1996 patient care data, the researchers analyzed 329 HMOs according to how well they performed in 14 areas such as prenatal care, infant immunization, and breast cancer screening. In every category, the not-for-profits had higher rates than for-profits. Not-for-profit HMOs screen an average of 75.1% of women for breast cancer compared with 69.4% for investor-owned plans. Okay, so, you know, basically... not-for-profits are better than for-profits. Not a terrible surprise, but to us radical Democrats out there. But good news nonetheless. Now, when we talk about for-profit medicine, one of the scary things coming down the road is the commodification of the body. And I'm not universally opposed to the commodification of the body because I think it's not the commodification of the body that's the problem. It's commodification and capitalism in general. And if we had a stronger left presence in American life, an anti-commodification presence, then all kinds of problems would be solved. An example of how commodification just kind of sneaks in is the scandal in September. Online shoppers bid more than $5.7 million for a human kidney offered on the internet auction site eBay before the company intervened to block the illegal sale. eBay has zero tolerance for illegal items on the site. We have a very clear policy against this. The item advertised as a fully functional kidney was put up for sale last week and had pulled the top bid of $5.7 million before the online auction house pulled the plug. So they weren't really sure whether it was legitimate or not, but they were trying to sell a kidney online. Now, the poor condition of American doctors has led the American Medical Association to say that they are going to try to organize unions, and more power to them. I'm all for physician unions because I think that physicians are going the way of many organized professions. That is, that there won't be physicians probably in about 50 years because computerization and online diagnostics and all other kinds of organizational incursions into medicine are going to make physicians pretty much irrelevant. But at any rate, in the meantime, they need to have their interests protected, just like any other set of workers, anybody else involved in healthcare. And so the AMA has decided on the name for their union, Physicians for Responsible Negotiations. The AMA chose the long version of the commonly used acronym PRN, Physicians Responsible Negotiations, which is a medical term that means as needed. And, you know, the poor AMA, because even when they get around to doing something right, they still screw it up. Basically, they've announced that they won't be doing any strikes. And, you know, physicians all over the world have been striking and strike when they need to strike. Here's an example of some physicians who are going to be really mad, I bet. In South Africa, state-employed doctors, specialists, and dentists will, from last Wednesday, no longer be allowed to run private practices. Previously, doctors employed by the government were allowed to engage in limited private practice, which meant that they could run a private practice as long as the practice was conducted outside of their normal 40-hour week. So, you know, American doctors think they have it bad, but in Britain, most physicians are employed by the government, and they're very happy about it, actually. Physicians who are employed by the government tend to be relatively happy with their situation. They're not angry about being employed by the government. And when Margaret Thatcher tried to privatize the British Health Service, she was she met a united front of British physicians against that idea. The British physicians like not having to charge their patients out of pocket for medical services, something that American physicians have always insisted that they must have. Okay, now, doctors across the country, because of the impact of managed care, have been very depressed, and I don't know if this doctor was depressed in particular about managed care, but a doctor who attempted suicide 2 years ago is suing the hospital that he worked for after doctors there saved his life following a stroke, ignoring his instructions to let him die. Dr. Marshall Clavin wrote a living will in 1993 asking that he never be kept alive on life support after being haunted for years by memories of his father's stroke. Today, the 67-year-old Clavin is living the life he tried to avoid. After doctors helped him recuperate from a stroke that followed his suicide attempt, he now sits in a wheelchair, unable to talk. The stroke left him physically and mentally incompetent, his lawyer said. The irony of all this is that he was determined not to go through what his dad went through. His dad had a devastating stroke and lived for years just drooling from the mouth. Now look where he's at. He's a man who can't see, can't read, can't speak, and can't take care of himself. So he's filed a wrongful life lawsuit against the Crozier Chester Medical Center. And, you know, there was a long time in this country in which the problem was the doctors did too much to us because they got paid to do more to us. You know, that was the whole fee-for-service medicine was a system in which the system made a profit off of you getting sick. It didn't have an incentive to keep you well. It had an incentive to treat you once you got sick. And it had an incentive to treat you to the point where it made you sick. It made you sicker by doing too much to you. Now, we instituted managed care 10, 15 years ago, slowly over the last period. And now it's getting to the point where managed care has ratcheted things down to the point where we're not providing care that is necessary in many circumstances. And, you know, I think that we do need cost control. The principal cost control we need in this country is a national single-payer public access system that would eliminate all the administrative nightmare of the 1,500 different insurance companies. But we don't need the kind of for-profit profiteering out of people's misery that managed care involves. So anyway, my opinion on managed care, not terribly surprising. But the point, bringing back to allowing people to die, managed care, one of the advantages that managed care has had, at least in the short term, is that it turns out that people in managed care die quicker. They're not being kept alive as long, as painfully, as the doctors under managed care are listening to patients when they say, I don't want to be resuscitated. They're taking these do not resuscitate orders very, very seriously. In Amsterdam, they have very wise policies on many things, and they have had also very wise policies on assisted suicide and euthanasia. The Dutch government has now published plans to legalize mercy killing under rules that would allow children as young as 12 to demand and receive euthanasia. Doctors carrying out euthanasia generally administer a lethal injection to their patients. Those assisting in suicides prescribe drug overdoses. Under the legislation proposed Tuesday, a patient must make a voluntary and informed request. The patient must be suffering irremediable and unbearable pain. All other medical options must be exhausted. A second opinion must be sought. Euthanasia must be carefully carried out. Physicians also must report each case to the coroner and to one of five regional panels made up of a lawyer, a doctor, and an ethics expert. The panel can recommend prosecution if it believes the doctor has not followed the guidelines. The new law also recognizes so-called euthanasia declarations, which are documents in which patients state that they want euthanasia even if they no longer are in a position to ask for it themselves, for example, if they're in a coma. So, the Dutch, way out ahead. Now, unfortunately, if you're in a vegetative state, generally you don't have the ability to make your wishes clear, and most relatives of people in vegetative states are loath to turn off the switch, and that's why we need policies about when people should, in vegetative states, have their life support scaled back, turned off. But it may be that there may be uses for people and vegetables in vegetative states, actual vegetables. It turns out that a yucca plant is the latest investor on the Stockholm Stock Exchange, issuing buy and sell orders on the exchange's 16 most traded shares. Swedish artist Ola Pearson has attached electrodes to the plant's leaves and through a sensor can feel the plant's growth with movements linked to a computer program tracking the 16 most active stocks. When the yucca stock recommendations perform better than the Bourse's general index, it's given water and light. If the plant fails to deliver profits, it stays dry and in the dark. The yucca is part of an exhibition by seven Swedish artists in Stockholm. And you know what I bet? I bet that at the base of that plant, there is animal dung. And so it's yet another example of absurd art using animal dung, but in this case, to fertilize a plant. Okay. So thinking about this, thinking about the importance of evolution vis-a-vis human progress, I've come up with a couple related articles here. One that I highly recommend is from the New York Times science section of September 14th, and you can find that at nyt.com. It's an article about what fuels progress in science, and competition, just as in the animal kingdom, the evolutionary process, natural selection, fuels progress, and sometimes cooperation fuels progress. It turns out, and this was the famous argument of Proudhon, Kropotkin, that natural selection wasn't the only story, competition wasn't the only story in explaining human progress, but also cooperation, because in fact our bodies are examples of multicellular organisms coming together to cooperate to form single-celled organisms coming together to form a multicelled organism. So cooperation, it can be seen all across the field. Anyway, this article is What Fuels Progress in Science, and it points out that competition and cooperation have both been shown to fuel progress in science, unlike the unhappy families of Tolstoy's Anna Karenina, which were all unhappy in different ways. No two scientific rivalries have precisely the same causes and consequences. Some skirmishes do little more than quicken the pace of research, as when Albert Einstein and David Hilbert, the German mathematician, raced each other for the first correct formulation of the equations of general relativity in 1915. Other spats have the effect of both drawing attention to an important research question while souring many scientists on ever working in the field. The classic case involved Dr. Alan Sandage of Carnegie Observatories in Pasadena, California, and the late Dr. Gerard de Vaucouleurs, the pair feud with ceaseless rancor in the 1970s and 80s over the rate at which the universe is expanding, called the Hubble constant. The consequences of that battle are still ricocheting through the world of scientific research today. Some scientists say the feud sparked their interest in the question. Dr. Sandish himself found it so unpleasant that he stopped attending scientific meetings. Still, other feuds appear to be entirely destructive, with little redeeming value for scientific research, like the bitter personal and professional split between Dr. Sung Dao Li and Dr. Chen Ning Yang, who won the Nobel Prize in 1957 for collaborative work on particle physics. Each now claims the lion's share of credit for the work, and the two have not spoken for 35 years. And that's just a piece of this article, What Fuels Progress in Science, Sometimes a Feud, in the New York Times. Now, switch over to computers. You would think that creativity would be something that that computers do particularly well, or that computers don't do particularly well, humans do particularly well. But it turns out that in the field of advertising, at least, and some may think that, of course, in the field of advertising, it's possible to design a computer program now that shows signs of creativity. Instead of batting around ideas in an atmosphere of tolerant experimentation, the computers worked alone and followed rules, and a panel of judges found the computer's work was in the same league with the work of professional ad makers and far better than that of amateurs, given total artistic freedom. This is an article in Science Magazine. Researchers Jacob Goldenberg, et cetera, from the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. They used a simple formula. Let's see. The computers came up with five ad ideas the judges decided were at least as good as advertisement concepts developed by humans. The principle that they used was that 89% of award-winning ads match as few as six formulas, which they called the creativity templates, and 25% of those could follow what they called the replacement template, that is a pattern that the computer program used to create its ad ideas for the study. The replacement program was... the thing you're trying to advertise has a particular feature, like speed, and so you choose something else that has speed. Like if you're trying to advertise a fast car, then you choose a gazelle and you match up images of gazelle with the car. And the computers were able to do that in a number of dramatic ways, and the judges like their ads. So now I'm going to have to save the rest of this material for next week and listen in. I have... In response to the list of potential interviewees that I posted on the Change Surfer site, people have been emailing me about what their preferences are for future interviews that I will conduct now in October and November in broadcast. And I just want to tell you about some of the interviews that I am arranging in response to your requests. I'm going to be talking to, hopefully, G. William Domhoff about the growing gender and ethnic diversity of America's power elite. Known as the ruling class to all you hardcore Marxists out there. Mark Rothstein on medical information confidentiality in the genetic era. The editors of Anything That Moves, the national bisexual magazine about biopolitics. Bill Winslade on the ethics of caring for the severely brain injured. I want to interview Princeton's Elaine Pagels on Gnosticism and Satan, her history of Satan. Also now at Princeton, the controversial Peter Singer, on his views on animals, babies, and the brain dead, and Robert Zubrin, who's at the Mars Society, and the related project now at MIT, very exciting project, Mars First, an organization that plans to commercialize the exploration of Mars. So check back next week for Change Surfer Radio. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. If you want to learn more about radical democratic posthumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about the show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's J-H-U-G-H-E-S at changesurfer.com. Also check out past and future shows and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com. Check back next week, the same time, for Change Surfer Radio.